This is theirs.
Leave us spinning in the wind up here.
You have the meeting.
Thank you, and it's our pleasure to be here with you, for sure. So hopefully you have our materials in front of you. We're going to be referencing this packet today. And before we get into that, I just wanted to outline roughly our agenda. So I'll walk you through the first tab, which is our quarterly investment landscape, giving our views on the macroeconomy and how it ties to the portfolio, of course, and then dive into the performance of the plan, and that will be tab two. Then I'll turn it over to Scott for tab three, which will be your first view of our risk dashboard on the plan. So some interesting things there. And then we'll wrap up with the discussion on the strategy development work plan. That sounds reasonable. I'll try to move briskly, but I am certainly attentive to any feedback, so feel free to stop me and ask questions, and eye rolls and yawns are also recognized.
Don't worry, we will.
I'm getting to that next.
Technically, you have to do it first.
Don't miss that.
Now that I'm about to get into the materials, there's a disclaimer in here. One of our disclaimers, and regarding confidentiality, and we were requested to give a verbal waiver of that confidentiality. So please accept this as our verbal waiver of the confidentiality. Okay. So let's jump into tab one. So this is our view of the world, and we provide this on a quarterly basis for you. And I think it's really easy to read and user-friendly. And I'd like to start with page four, because this really gives a nice summary of what we're seeing in the economy. And so we have a few key bullet points divided up into these four sections: the economic climate and the investment climate. Those are two different things to us. The market portfolio impacts and the asset allocation issues. And we have handy page references along the line as well, and so that makes it convenient. And as we go through this quarter after quarter, it develops a rhythm, develops kind of a sense of where you think we see things, and you'll probably come to appreciate how we see things in advance of us telling you that. So, you know, as that happens, we'll kind of let that naturally flow and then be more of answering questions or highlighting unique things that we're seeing, really do more of the exception spotting. And today, along those same lines, I'm going to highlight in the upper left-hand corner two of those three bullets, the second two: the European quantitative easing, referencing page 22, and low inflation, referencing page 12. So we'll come back to those in a minute. Low inflation is a key part of the story that we're seeing here in the U.S. and globally. And the European quantitative easing, which has just begun, could be a very important component to international equity and fixed income returns. First, I'd like, though, to turn to page six, because this is a nice economic summary of what we see here in the U.S. And as we study the international markets, and we look at what's happening, a lot of it comes out of what the U.S. is doing, because we are such a key component to global GDP. And so this chart is a handy reference point of seeing where we were at the end of the quarter, and some of these numbers have updated. For example, the 10-year rate that you see in the chart towards the bottom shows here 1.92%. Earlier this morning, that number was at 2.13%, and that's a pretty sizable move in our local interest rates here, 10-year U.S. Treasury. Similarly, the U3 unemployment at 5.5 has bumped down just a smidge to 5.4, and that shows some volatility, so it could easily jump back to 5.5, but it's remarkable how low that unemployment number is. And to have a bigger picture of that, the U6 unemployment, which basically incorporates not just people participating in the labor market, but everyone standing on the sidelines not participating, shows that we have many more people unemployed or not actively engaged, and that's 10.9%. So that's down from a year ago, 12.6% a year ago. So that's good news, and that's showing that more people are coming back into the workforce. But that's a key stat for us, because when we look at what the potential of the U.S. economy is, and recognizing that there are that many people sitting on the sidelines, getting them back in the workforce is a key part of our growth. Also, we tie that into where we see wage rates, and wage rates have not been increasing much either. And so when we think about our global economy and what's going on here, people being employed is a key step, and people earning more in the future is a key step to seeing real economic growth. We're not seeing that yet. And so that gives us some pause in terms of what the Fed is doing with their economic policy. They've been very stimulative, keeping rates very low. They're out of the quantitative easing game, okay? But there's the discussion now, will the Fed raise rates? Will they raise rates in September? Will they raise rates in June? June seems to be off the table. April is certainly off the table. Now the market's kind of pricing in September, and with these numbers, we're not seeing a strong indication that they need to. In fact, there's some reason to say the weakness in our economy at 0% is fine. So,
Ed, what's your reaction to the healthy jump to 2.13%? I mean, I realize it just happened, but do you have any initial take on it?
On the 10-year Treasury rate?
Yes,
the 10-year rate. Part of that is a reflection of growth and fear. And so 1.92% is an indicator of a lot of risk aversion, that there's a lot of views that my money is safer earning 1.9%, and I like that, as opposed to investing it elsewhere where I can get higher returns. So as the investors say, 1.9 is too low, we can do better elsewhere, then they pull that money out and we see the rates rise and they start to invest elsewhere. So that kind of ties into the global growth story, or at least the U.S. growth story, that there are better investment opportunities elsewhere.
It sounds like it was a surprise, though.
Interest rates are always a surprise. Now, it's...
It's such a public environment, though, with the Fed's discussing it. You know, you get daily, weekly reports. There's anticipation of testimony, and it's so closely watched. I don't know how great a secret it is, but it just seemed like this was a bigger jump than maybe anticipated.
It was a quicker jump. So going from 192 to 213 is a pretty sizable move in a short amount of time.
Okay.
So it's more of that dynamic, the magnitude and the timing. And it being a surprise.
Okay.
This also coincides with people like Bill Gross, Jeffrey Gundlach saying the German Bund is, Bill Gross's words were, the greatest short of a lifetime. So he wanted to short the German Bund, and it was at a negative yield. And so rates in general were very low at that time, and there was a bit of a sell-off throughout the bond market. Let's take a look at the inflation on page 12. So the inflation is the other side of our Federal Reserve's mandate in terms of stimulating growth, maintaining low unemployment, and keeping inflation at bay. And inflation is a broad term. When you think about where you're seeing inflation in wages or in equity prices or in consumer services versus consumer staples versus durables, there are lots of different pieces that roll up into this. Inflation, as captured by CPI, is one metric, and it has a lot of flaws to it, too. But it is the one that is popularly used, along with several others. And so here we paint that picture for you. So you can see the long-term CPI and how volatile it is, but how it has been trending downward, consistent with medium term. And so you see that, in general, we're looking at inflation rates of about 2%. What we also like to look at is in the lower right-hand corner, the five-year forward. And this is basically saying if we take a look at five-year and 10-year bonds, we can take a look at the treasuries, and we can take a look at TIPS, which have the inflation protection by our U.S. government. And we can look at the differences between those four categories. We can get a view, or the market's view, of how it is pricing future inflation. So this is a way of saying, what does the market think inflation will be for five-year period, 5 years from now? So basically in 2020 to 2025. And here you're seeing that it has come down as well. So it's about 2%. So there's no real signs of inflation. We don't see it in current CPI, and we don't see the market pricing in future inflation either. And so between those two, and knowing what the Fed's mandate is to keep inflation low, they don't see a real need to raise rates, at least not by an inflation metric. So, yes, sir.
Ed, one of the things that strikes me is there's never any discussion on mandating higher minimum wages and inflation, at least that there's a causation. If you raise wages, you're going to obviously increase at some point the price of the service or product. Where does that come in at all here? Is it so minimal, notwithstanding the publicity, that it really doesn't have any impact?
Yeah, so the wage inflation doesn't tie into the CPI metrics until it actually ties into the price of goods raising.
I'm thinking of the five-year forward, I guess, and asking that question.
Right. So there, you could look at this and say, is the market dismissing it? Do they think it's not a big concern? Or is that just a small contribution to the 2% that we're seeing here? And you think about some of the deflationary characteristics, a lot of your consumer staples have continued to decline in price against this backdrop. So there are some offsetting things as well in it.
Except for eggs.
I'm sorry?
Except for eggs.
Yeah.
Milk.
Right.
A lot of things went the other way. So.
That's true. The economists who like to look at inflation core, who don't have to apparently drive or eat.
Yeah.
That's a nice luxury. I wish we all had that.
Exactly.
To your point, though, the wage inflation is another key component we think about in the economy, because the ability of a consumer to have higher wages and also the ability to borrow are the two components that allow them to buy more. And borrowing has been really difficult because the banks have been so conservative. Increased wages haven't been there. Their ability to buy more in the future has been very limited. And until we see a real change there, we too wouldn't expect inflation to really increase dramatically. So that's inflation. I wanted to jump to page 22, was the other key point, where we take a look at global yield curves. And this is an interesting chart on several dimensions for sure, because the top line we're showing here, the blue line is China, and the next one down is the U.S. And that's the U.S. yield curve over the 3-month to 30-year time period. And you can see it's still considerably a what economists consider a steep yield curve. And no signs of that changing, even if short-term interest rates did increase. It would still be fairly steep. It's also interesting when you take a look at the bottom line, which is Germany. And this gets back to the Bill Gross comment about German bonds are the short of a lifetime. Here you can see that the negative yield on German bonds goes out to 7 years. So there was a lot of buying of Germany and France bonds here, which is shown in the orange line as well. So it's interesting to see how low interest rates are globally, and to keep that in perspective. And it also helps us think about the discussion about in the U.S., rates must rise. And we've heard that for 20 years. And it tends to get louder and louder each year, rates must rise. And you take a look globally, and maybe they don't have to at all. Maybe they can continue lowering in quite a bit. So this chart is as of 3/31. It's changed a bit since then. But it does sort of temper the enthusiasm that rates must rise discussion has. And then I'd like to finally discuss page 47. 47 is what we call the periodic table of returns. It's though it looks like the periodic chart of the elements. You've probably seen this before. It's certainly a common tool used.
It's a nightmare in high school chemistry. It's really difficult.
Hopefully we'll make it a little better today. It is an eye chart, and our color coding and the color fonts at the bottom make it a little tough to tie those together. So I'll help out a little bit here. We have all of the calendar years here, as well as year-to-date for first quarter. And then we have the 5 and 10-year to the right. And the 10-year column is pretty interesting. That top number, the 10.0%, is small-cap growth. So small-cap growth was the place to be over the past 10 years, certainly with volatility, and this doesn't pick up on the volatility you had to endure to get that 10%. But that's the winner so far. As you go down the list, we would next have large-cap growth and emerging market equity. And so that's interesting, because emerging market equity, you think about the risk you take both in emerging market economies, in the companies that are in emerging markets, and the currency component to emerging markets, you would want to be compensated for taking on that risk. Here, you've gotten 8.8% over the past 10 years, so certainly not too bad, but yet lower than our domestic small cap growth. Then we go down, the next one is small cap, then real estate. So real estate has had a nice recovery coming out of 2008, and so much so that it is now a top 5 asset class. And this one has demonstrated a lot less volatility, and we're going to see, as I'm sure you're all aware, that the plan has been nicely allocated to real estate, and that's been a key contributor to returns. We can go down to the dark blue, 7.5%. That's a 60-40 portfolio, and so you can think about that as being where most public pension plans are, plus or minus, in that 60-40 range. Then you go down another two lines, and you have a 5.4% for international equity. And international equity, again, taking on international exposure and currency risk, but not really compensated for it. And so when we think about that 5.4% versus the nines and tens that we're seeing in domestic growth side of the equation, we think that this might create some valuation opportunity. And so tying back to that first point, quantitative easing has really only just begun with the ECB in Europe. And you think about where we were with quantitative easing 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the dramatic effect it has had on our equity markets. They're trying to do the same. Europe is a different story. They have a different mechanism in place than our Federal Reserve, so it's not quite the same, apples to apples. And they also have their own headwinds. So Greece, for example, is currently an issue. Ukraine, Russia can be an issue. Italy has been an issue. So they have their individual stories to tell there. But when you have a backdrop of Mario Draghi making the statement, whatever it takes in terms of supporting the local economy, and then not doing anything for a couple years until ECB finally develops a quantitative easing program, now it looks like they're starting to back up those words. So recognizing that the international equity markets have not had the appreciation that we have had, and with that economic backdrop, there might be some nice opportunity there, certainly with some volatility. We expect that it's going to be not a smooth road, but somewhat choppy. So let me pause there for our view on the market, see if there are any questions. If not, we'll move into the portfolio itself.
Any questions?
Okay. So if we go to tab two, there are two real components I want to bring out in terms of this report. One is the format, the look and feel, where you find things, how you like to see things. We're certainly receptive to feedback on the way this is presented. This is certainly our best first attempt in working with Tim and staff to think through the issues, working with what was presented in the Milliman reports, making sure there's some consistency, and bringing to you what we think are our best practices and what we think is an intuitive way of looking at the plan. And so when we begin on page one, we take a look at the portfolio reconciliation and just really looking at the cash balance of the plan. 3 months ago, December 31st, the plan closed the year at $7 billion. You see the net withdrawals during the quarter, investment earnings, and ending market value of about $7.2 billion. So we think that this is a very intuitive way of looking at how much the plan is growing. And page two then puts a chart to this on the left-hand side where we have the market value history. So it looks like crossing the $7 billion threshold is a first for the plan. So that's a pretty exciting threshold to cross. And against net cash flows, which you can see at the bottom, the green portion of that chart. And overall, I think this chart really shows the success of the plan, that assets are growing while benefit payments are being made and expenses are being absorbed. On the right-hand side of page two, we have the asset allocation history, and you can see how consistent the approach has been over the past 5 years, from 2009 to current. The notable change is the inflation hedge slash real assets, which is reflected in the orange portion of that chart. But a very consistent approach. Page three then helps us take this policy and current allocation and make sure that we're in line with our policy. And so the table in the upper right-hand corner has the last column within IPS range. Gives us a quick check. We have all yeses there. We're within the investment policy statement ranges, so we're fulfilling that checkbox. We also have the current and long-term targets. And so this ties back to the Milliman memo of 2011 that recognized in the process of getting from your current asset allocation to your target asset allocation, that's going to take time because a lot of it requires investment in private equity, and it takes time to fund that. So there's a current target allocation as kind of an intermediate step. So this is designed to reflect that. So we have the current allocation against the long-term target, and the bottom table is the current allocation against the current target. And by and large, these are not significantly different. So we are currently at 45.7% with a current target of 46.6, a long term of 42.6, roughly in line, slightly overweight global equity. Similarly, slightly underweight global fixed income, currently at 23.5, a long term of 24.4. And very much in line with high yield, inflation, real estate slightly over, alternatives, 7.2, a long-term target of 10, so that's the part that is still building, and then opportunistic and cash.
Okay.
Pages 4 and 5 are mostly looking at the total plan. And here we take a look at the performance in the table on the upper left-hand side. Total plan of 3.6% for the quarter. Policy index at 2.6, so nicely outperformed that. CPI plus 4, the other benchmark we look at for the plan, at 1.5. And then we have the investor force, public DB, greater than $1 billion rank. And you can see that these ranks are pretty impressive. For the quarter, first percentile. Year-to-date, first percentile. There really isn't any higher. One is best. 1 year, 3 year. 5 and 10. So very strong numbers, and certainly to be commended.
Do you want to say something about setting expectations that there's no way we're going to be able to keep that up? I'm just kidding.
Well, actually, I had a question. I don't know if it's a question or a comment about that. I think the performance reflects wise asset allocation strategy and our investment officer and our approach. I mean, it's hard to argue with the fact that the numbers are good. So I guess the question is, I'm in that, it doesn't appear broke, but we seem intent on fixing it. And maybe this is a Scott question versus an Ed question, but we're going to go through a rather significant look at this, and we're going to sort of Maybe we're going to deconstruct it and put it all back together again, I guess. Does it strike you that that's necessary if you look at this data? If you were just parachuting in and you were looking at this and you were doing peer review and just giving a comment, would you have an inherent sense that you wanted to change it?
So the fact that it's not broke doesn't, and so I think your statement that it's not broke and we seem intent on fixing it, right? We're not intent on doing anything other than just evaluating the plan, bringing our evaluation and assessment back to you, and seeing if there are any changes that could or should be made. So
yeah, look at it. We're successful because we are doing things like this. So it's kind of what we've been doing all along, just another version of it.
At the end of the day, we're going to provide you with a bunch of different alternatives, one of it which will be your current alternative, and try to give you an intuitive understanding of what any changes that you make will have on your expected future performance, your future outcomes. So you may very well end up in the same place where you are right now. Maybe there are some tweaks. Maybe there are some major changes that you want to make. But we want to present those to you with an intuitive understanding of what you can expect from each of those changes.
Rusty.
Just want to understand what you mean by selection effect. Is that the selection of managers or selection of assets?
Yes. You're giving me a perfect segue into the right-hand side of this page.
Right.
I will pick up on that. Just one other comment to add on to Scott's comments to Scott is that I think that the process will also be our learning process as well, so us sort of getting in sync with you. I think there's a natural curiosity and something that we want to make sure that we think through the issues, that we're not silent to them or assuming them away, but we've addressed them. So I think there's that process.
Ed, I had a quick mechanical question, and I think it's clear, but thought I'd just ask you to confirm it. We say CPA plus 4%, and we say for the quarter 1.5. I assume that 4% one-fourth of that is one. CPI at 3 months is 0.5, and that's where that comes from. So that the end of the half, we'll be talking about 2%, 2 plus whatever CPI is.
Right.
And if it continues on a half a percent, a quarter basis, aiming towards 2% for the year, then it would be 2.5 and et cetera.
Correct.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. Any other questions?
Jerry?
Two things. One is, I see this as tweaking our system to improve it or to look at it and see if there is. Two is, our asset allocation study, when is the next asset allocation study?
It's fall. They're going to talk about that in their work plan. It's a later agenda item, basically third or fourth quarter of this year.
Really? It's coming that soon? Okay.
The liability
then I'm on board. Good. Thank you.
I think in your proposal, by the way, if I recall it correctly, you were complimentary as to our current holdings, our current asset allocation, and what we hold and how it is performed. That was my recollection. And you said nice things about it, and you did not say that there was any significant change that you observed.
Correct.
You had a couple of minor ones, but not big ones.
The tweaking.
Well, I'll let you speak first to the attribution, because then I will follow up on that comment there, too. Go ahead. Okay.
So, on the right-hand side of this page, we're showing the attribution, which is basically saying, how does the plan allocate versus its policy index? And so here, when we think about selection, we're thinking about how much is allocated to each individual manager. So it's not the selection within the manager, it's the selection of the managers. So that's what the selection effect is. Because the current asset allocation is very close to in line with policy index, the allocation effect, which is reflected in blue, is relatively minimal. So in across the board, you're seeing relatively small blues, and then they add up to the total fund of a smidge. The orange dot is then the total effect, which is basically saying, if you look at the top of page 4, that orange dot is falling right around 1%, which is to say that the fund outperformed the policy by 1%, which you see on the left-hand side, 3.6 versus 2.6. So that's how that ties together. And then each of the individual orange dots sum up to that 1%. So you can see with this chart that, A, we got some nice outperformance. B, it's largely because of the allocation to the managers. And C, within the asset classes, it's within domestic equity and real estate that generated the most return there for us. Does that make sense? There's also the interaction effect, which is kind of the other to make the numbers add up, and it kind of captures the dynamic between the allocation and the selection effects to make it all come together.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay.
Yeah. Can I just go back to your comment? I mean, if I understand the attribution table here, it seems like we are on the right track. And what helps our situation better is that we're selecting great managers as well as selecting an allocation that's working for us. So anyway, I don't see any change happening in the future either, but we'll see what you come back with as recommendations.
Good. Okay. Page 6 is a similar attribution. This is done on a net of fees basis. So nothing dramatic there. Page 7 is a handy way of looking at the risk and return profile of the plan. And this captures a 5-year basis, so it takes a look at the past 5 years. It captures these metrics, risk and return, and upmarket and downmarket capture ratios. And this is a handy way of looking at how is the plan actually performed relative to the asset allocation that was put in place. And so typically when you go through an asset allocation study, you have to make some determination that there's a risk return acceptable levels here. So we're willing to accept something like 12% standard deviation. We're hoping to get 7% return. That's kind of some average numbers we see in the industry. And here you can see that your average annualized return over the 5 years is actually much higher than 7. You're getting 11, which is nice, against an annualized standard deviation that's a little bit below 9%. So if you're thinking about targeting 12 and you actually got 9, it's better across both of those metrics than you probably were assuming. So some of this is instructive in terms of asset allocation studies can be very precise. They can be taken out to a second or third decimal point, but then you realize that the actual realities can differ pretty significantly. It's also a handy tracking metric to see, okay, so how are we doing 5 years later, and how are the numbers actually panning out? So a handy way of thinking about both of those dynamics and captured on a quarterly basis. Page 8 has some additional risk statistics that we'll be getting more into as time goes on. So these are just some of the historical rolling information ratios, tracking error, upmarket and downmarket capture ratios. I think the interesting one here is in the lower right-hand corner. The rolling downmarket capture ratio on a 3-year basis spiked pretty significantly in 2014. And that's interesting because there haven't been a lot of downmarkets over, and this is on a quarterly basis. So over the past 3 years, that's really only capturing the third quarter of 2014, which was down modestly, and the second quarter of 2012, where the plan was down about 1.3% and the index was down about 0.5%. So this chart in and of itself looks like, wow, surprising. How did we get that much down market capture? And it's really just only two quarters, and they weren't big deal. We just captured more of the downside than the index. The next series of pages go through the individual managers. And so this gives us a chance to think about each individual manager and how they contributed and how they're doing versus their benchmarks and versus their competitive universes. Just a couple highlights to make here. Intech Large Cap Core had a really strong quarter, both against its benchmark and against its universe. So we see that it ranked in the sixth percentile. So very strong. It has a pretty sizable allocation to small cap. And small cap stocks did better in the quarter than the large caps, and so its 25% weight to small cap stocks certainly helped drive its performance. A little bit down below that, Emerald Advisors also outperformed nicely, 9.9% versus 6.6, and also ranking in the sixth percentile. So it also had pretty impressive numbers due to some technology and materials and healthcare selection. We have the international equities, nothing particularly noteworthy there.
Yes, go back. I just noticed something. Certex is also small cap, U.S. small cap value equity, and they're in the 60, you ranked them in the 62nd. Why? Can you give me some reason why they didn't do as well as Emerald or Intech?
So different universes, because Emerald is Russell 2000 growth. Uh-huh. Versus Certex in 2000 value. So value did not
value
do nearly
didn't
as,
do
well.
As well. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
And then it did outperform 2.6 versus 2, but ranking in the 67th percentile indicates that a number of other managers also outperformed the index by more. So it's just a relative.
Okay.
Turning to global equities, we have notable performance from Artisan Partners ranking in the 14th percentile. Mainly due to some healthcare and technology selection there. Nothing particularly noteworthy there. JP Morgan didn't do as great on a relative basis, 70th percentile, but roughly in line with its index, 2.2 versus 2.3. In the fixed income space, Goldman Sachs Core Plus really did well, first percentile. So they had some nice exposure to some corporates, as well as some munis and some securitized. So it's interesting to see a Core Plus manager get into the munis. That's considered a cross trade because munis are generally tax-free. There are taxable munis, but they're investing in a space that most Core Plus managers don't go. Some do. And that was a contributor to performance this time. Certainly a few managers who highlighted.
Question for Tim. Tim, does Goldman Sachs still have the manager that they had when we hired him? It's still the same.
Goldman Sachs, you're buying into the machine of Goldman Sachs, and they're rotating cast of characters, but our individual points of contact have remained the same. The heads of the fixed income group, I think, have changed two or three times. But the individual PM.
It's still the same.
It's Mike Swell.
Yeah.
Mike Swell and Mike Gosset. Basically, all the manufacturing divisions of high yield and munis, the heads of all those have changed. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Looking at page 11, we get into PIMCO total return. It's roughly in line with the index, not a great relative ranking, 81st percentile, but I think we've had a series of ongoing discussions about the PIMCO strategy, so I won't get into that here now. Torchlight, we get into closed-end strategies here, so they have different performance metrics, really, and we have a different set of performance pages we'll get to in a moment. On the private equity, private debt, and real estate funds. High yield.
On total return, I have been reading that they were well ahead of the benchmark. Obviously, this puts them right about at it for the quarter. So I guess my question is, as of more current, have they moved ahead of the benchmark, or are they continuing to stay right at it? Or
I do remember something about April being a strong month for them. Do you So,
John, just recall that we are not invested in a broad total return strategy right now. We have taken our universe and restricted it to basically an index-esque position, all in physical securities, in order to safeguard our assets from the flows associated with the broader total return strategy. So we have, call it an index fund, slightly plus on the credit selection. So,
but it presumably mirrors total return.
No.
Oh, it doesn't?
No, because we have dramatically reduced their investable opportunity set to physical bonds that are in the Barclays Aggregate.
So
we allow them to do some credit selection in the just on the credit opportunity side or on the credit side. But we are expecting index-like returns, return for safeguarding our assets on a temporary basis.
It's also worth noting that the total return fund, right, is this big behemoth that follows a certain implementation strategy, right? So the total return fund and then the separate account total return strategies could be implemented differently even if you hadn't made that change to your portfolio. I've got a couple of clients with separate account total return strategies that are implemented by different portfolio managers. They follow kind of the general guidelines that PIMCO follows with the total return mutual fund, but they're implemented differently. And I'm finding that the total return, separate account total return strategies are not keeping up with the total return fund that you're reading about.
Okay.
So just to clarify, the PIMCO total return numbers here is actually what Cicera is reporting.
Correct.
Cicera has
not the total return broad fund.
Yes. Cicera has always had a separate account with the total return strategy. We have restricted that strategy on a temporary basis.
Yeah.
So, as I mentioned then, we have some different performance reporting on the real estate and private. So these are informative, but knowing that we mainly look at IRR calculations when we talk about those, I'm going to ask you to skip ahead a bit. Page 15 has the same performance that we just discussed, but on a net of fees basis. So the stories and attributions don't change. Unfortunately, all the numbers come down just a touch as they take out their fees, as you might expect. The closed-end funds then really begin on page 20. And we have this broken out into two components. The first is the closed-end funds investment summary, which is 20, 21, and 22. And what we're showing here is the inception date in the left-hand side of each one of these strategies and the estimated market value as of 3/31. And so it's estimated because we're trying to show you the most current number to be consistent with the report, knowing that a lot of this information is reported on a lag. So we have the 12/31 number. We account for the cash flows that we've made or we've received to get to the estimated market value. So it doesn't account then for the appreciation or depreciation during the first quarter. Thus, it's estimated. Then we have the total commitment, what's been committed, and how much has been called so far and the percent called. So it's mainly a schedule of cash flows from here on out. What the remaining commitment is, what we've received back in terms of total distributions, then a couple of the metrics, distributions over the paid-in capital and the total value relative to the paid-in, and then the latest valuation date. So I think these are handy ways of looking at each investment strategy and the progression from inception to current. Nothing particularly notable, but that's the format. Page 23 then shows the IRRs for these, and this is really the way we like to look at these things. So here we have each strategy again outlined with the inception date. So that helps us think about inception date through current and how much time period has these IRRs have cover. And then we have the fund level on a gross of fees basis and contra costa on a gross of fees basis, the fund level net of fees and contra costa net of fees. And so those are all handy for comparison purposes, depending on how we want to think about different particular issues. So we are still in the process of getting to dig into all of the IMAs and all of the strategies, familiar with many of the managers, but the specific of how contra costa is invested is still part of our current state assessment process, and that's not been completed yet. So we don't have any particularly interesting notes to make at this point, but this is, again, more about the format of the report and how we're reflecting this, too. And then page 25 gets into various risk return metrics across each of the strategies. And then 26 through the end of the report provides a lot more of the charts and numbers behind each strategy, which can be handy when we want to dig into a particular issue. But by and large, we have those for reference if needed. So let me just pause there, see if there are any questions about the report before we dive into the risk dashboard.
I'm sorry, question from Peter.
Is that compared to our own policy benchmark?
Yes. Yes.
So the deviation could come from mostly from the
The monthly value. Yeah, that's going to be a key driver of it. Yeah.
So would it be more revealing compared to some other evidence to show our active value at its location?
We could. I think that probably becomes part of a philosophical discussion about how we want to view the performance. It could be an outcome of, as we do the assessment and think about the longer-term strategy for the plan of how we'd want to compare that.
So did you have something in mind? This is the way that we show it is a sort of an industry standard. There is another industry standard approach where you start with cash and then you build up the different risks that you take until you get to fully the full portfolio number. So you start with cash and you get to then the risk-free rate, and then you get to your policy allocation, and then you get to active management. This is sort of a standard industry approach where you take active and allocation effects and you separate those two out.
Because if you keep looking at your own benchmark, it's going to be very similar every time.
So yeah, the allocation effect will be similar for sure, right? Because you're not doing much, you're not varying much from your policy allocation.
Good. All done?
Okay. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the risk dashboard before moving into the plan. Before I even get to the risk dashboard, I wanted to say something generally about the dynamics as new teams are forming, which is what I sort of consider us. We're forming a team with your staff. We're forming a team with the board. And there's, I come from management consulting way back in my early career, and there was the saying that teams go through four stages, right? They go through forming, storming, norming, and performing. And I want to raise your awareness of these four stages because right now we're in the forming stage. We are setting expectations. You're kind of learning what you can expect from us. We're learning what we can expect from you and from staff. It's inevitable that we will get to a storming stage, right, where those expectations on either side may be a little bit different, may not be met. You guys are going to have to guide us, and we'll continue to work to meet your expectations. Then, of course, there's the norming stage where new expectations are set and those expectations are met. And then, of course, you finally get to performing where everything's running like a Swiss watch. So our job is to compress those four stages as quickly as possible. But I did want to at least raise your awareness about those four stages. I think, I've done this many, many times in many different environments, and those four stages pretty much always play out that way. That said, let's move to the risk dashboard. And here, we're just talking about starting to build awareness. And I want to hit on a couple of points. I'm not going to dive into this very deeply. I think as we present these more and more, you'll get awareness, then you'll get familiarity, and then you'll get expertise on these things when they really become meaningful. This is also a tool for staff as they build some expertise on this to help them set their expectations on whether the portfolio is performing in line with the strategy that you've put in place. Couple of things to say about this at the front. This is an index-based risk dashboard. versus a security level risk dashboard. So what you're seeing is all these risks are reflective of the indexes that you have in your policy index. It does not take every security that you have and build it up to these high level metrics. That capability is available. There's a lot more to it, and of course it comes with a price tag. At some point, you guys may decide that you want a security level risk dashboard, but it's important to point out that this is not that. Also, we're talking about ex-ante risk here. So let me take a minute and describe what ex-ante risk is. It's sort of a misnomer. In fact, I think it's a complete misnomer. What it does is it takes today's portfolio, or in this case, March 31st, it looks back into the past at what that historic risk has been with today's portfolio. And that ex-ante means like projecting out into the future. Right? It's not. It's today's portfolio taking into account recent past experience. And then that says, okay, well, if that's true, then here's what you can expect going forward. So ex ante is not what this is. It doesn't predict the next 2008 and help you avoid that. Right? What this is designed to do is say, what does today's portfolio look like? Are we comfortable that the risks with the risks that we're taking in today's portfolio? And it helps you intuitively understand those risks that you're taking relative to the risks that you accepted by putting your investment strategy in place. That's
how far all. Does it look back?
I wish I had my risk guy here to tell you that. It's we use the BARA modeling tool, which has a certain set of parameters to look back. I would guess 3 years, but I would have to get back to you on that, right? So all that said, let's take a look at some of these metrics. So the way that you can look at this first page behind tab 3 is you can compare yourself to your policy, and as you would expect, those would be right on top of each other. Why? Because you're not deviating much from, it goes back to Chi-Chi's point, you're not deviating much from your policy allocation. The only differences would be allocation differences and methodological differences, and there are a couple of those. But the average of those methodological differences basically get you back to right on top of your policy risk. So the overall standard deviation risk on an ex-ante basis that you can expect is 7.3%, just slightly below the 7.4 risk that your policy is giving you. You can also compare that to your average pension, which we find is sort of an interesting comparison. The average pension is designed broadly as a peer comparison. It's broadly designed as a 60-40 with much broader diversification, but essentially the risks are 60-40 type risks.
Could you include the average pensions? Like, what are the ones?
There's a couple of pages of detailed footnotes in the back.
Not looking at it.
See it. And it should be in here. But it's not jumping out at me.
Is it like Taft Hartley's as well? And
well, so we've defined it. So and it's something like the domestic equity and the international equity are at parity, right? So for a broadly 60-40 portfolio, there's real estate in there. There is some commodities in there. There's some hedge funds and some private equity in there. So those are the asset classes, and the percentages are much like you would see with any of your peers. It's not too far from a Taft-Hartley, because those are kind of the Taft-Hartley investments as well. Taft-Hartley and Publix are not too far apart, but we defined it to be something that looks like your typical pension fund, okay? And I'll make sure that footnote is included in the back so that you have that to refer to. You go down to your portfolio equity, and so this is the equity exposure that you have in your portfolio, and you can see, again, you're very close to policy. So meeting your expectations is, if these lines were far off, we'd have something to talk about. But the expectations are being met, again, sort of close to the average pension. I'm not going to spend much time on the next slide. I do want to touch on slide 3. This shows your exposures by asset class. And this is, just your standard It's always good to think about risks from a risk bucket perspective or a risk allocation perspective, how much equity risk, rate risk, credit risk, et cetera. But it's also, going back to what people traditionally look at, how are we doing relative to our policy allocations? And it's important to ensure that you're staying on top of those. The next slide I want to take you to is slide 7, all the way out to slide 7. And here you can see your tail risk. So these are when the bad events happen, and this gets to how much risk can we really stomach. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about this when we go through your enterprise risk tolerance during the interviews and then again during the strategy development session. And you'll see these charts again with the varying investment strategies. But here, again, it's okay, what is our investment strategy? How do we look relative to that? And are these scenarios that we can stomach in the worst of times? So you just compare this to your policy and to your average pension. There are a couple of differences here, notably the 97 to 99 oil price decline and the 72 to 74 oil crisis. And you can see that in each one of those scenarios, you're a little bit better than and worse than policy and the average pension, respectively. That really gets to those methodological differences where BARA models private assets differently than your policy indexes are reflected. And so that's just kind of a unique situation with the modeling and nothing about your policy where you're taking risks that you shouldn't be taking.
Scott, something that just jumped out to me as you were walking us through this, we described the 1997 to 99 as an oil price decline.
As opposed to a tech bubble?
As opposed to a tech bubble, but we go up to 2001 and describe it as a dot-com slowdown.
These are the names. So BARA has a list of 300 scenarios that you can model. These are the ones that our folks in our risk management group pulled out as representative of things that people should be thinking about. And these are the BARA names. So I don't know why they didn't say tech bubble.
Well, so scenario analysis is an interesting area of research where the endpoints are very specific for each of these. And so whenever they're crafted, they're looking at the specific day that this happens to this happens. And that will define what the oil price decline is, which is different than the dot-com bubble being on this day to this day. And it's really interesting when you get into it, because when you adjust those days plus or minus, it can have a dramatic impact on what the event is. And you think about some of the short-term things, like the flash crash we just had not too long ago. That's a one-day event. You know, what happens on that day? In fact, it's almost an intraday event. So a lot of these have to do with that, and it's the specificity around the selection.
I thought the use of the term slowdown for what happened in March 2001 was generous. I think others described it differently.
I'll give you Barra's number and you can call him. Just debate the names. But I think you get the point, right? This is designed to give you a sense of, during that period of time, what would happen to your portfolio if it went through it. And really it's designed to give you a sense of, can we stomach this? Right? When we go through the full-blown investment strategy development process, we'll put many more metrics around these things to give you an intuitive sense of whether you can stomach it or not. What does it really mean in terms of your contribution rates as a percent of pay, your funded ratios, et cetera? Okay. Similar down at the bottom, what this does is it just takes that element of the portfolio that is exposed to, say, for example, global interest rates going up 200 basis points. It doesn't include correlations, right? So if global interest rates go up 200 basis points, it doesn't have any effect of what would happen to equities. It's just that element of your portfolio that's exposed to global interest rates, to give you an idea. We could model correlations and think about all that, but as the folks in our risk management group said, you know what, those are all estimates that muddy the waters when looking at these things, and we don't really know what will happen to correlations in any given scenario, so let's just model the impact on that element of the portfolio that is directly tied to that particular event and give an understanding of what would happen in the portfolio in that case. So it's a very simplified version of what would happen, and it really goes to your specific exposures in the portfolio. That is really all I wanted to show today, just to kind of begin to get you aware and familiar with this risk dashboard, what we intend to use it for. Each time we bring this to you, we'll review what we've reviewed and bring you something new and certainly point out anything that is impactful. But as we look at this, it should comfort you that the risks in your portfolio are very close to the risks that you accepted when you set your investment strategy up. Okay, so this is, to me, this next section is really the fun stuff. It's starting to talk about, you know, forward-looking and the process that we're going to go through to maybe confirm where you are today or maybe make some adjustments to the portfolio. So I wanted to share with you the process. Again, set your expectations on what the next several months will look like.
Scott, please. Going to agenda item 7.
Yes, thank you for that. So do we need any closure on agenda item 6 before moving ahead to agenda item 7?
Any questions?
We're going to agenda 6.
Okay, so we're moving to 6.
Is it our custom, I'm trying to remember, to move acceptance of the report for the first quarter? Do we routinely move that acceptance, or do we?
You may do that. I don't think it's been the custom of the board to do that.
No, that's fine. If we don't need to make a motion, that's fine. I just couldn't remember. It's a failing of age.
And number 5, John, before we dive into.
We can take it out of order. I'm
attempting to follow the lead of Scott.
Let's go ahead and 5.
All right, so you're going to 5? All right.